The following message is brought to you by MacArthur Boulevard Baptist Church. We are many stories made one family by one gospel. If you would like to connect with us, please check out our website at MacArthurBoulevard.org.
If you have a copy of God's Word, I invite you to go ahead and you can make your way back to the book of Exodus. If you're visiting with us this morning, we've been walking through the book of Exodus together for some time now. And we come to chapter 14 this morning. We actually come to what is perhaps the most recognizable event of the entire story of the Exodus, maybe one of the most recognizable events in all of the Bible, namely when God divided the Red Sea, delivering Israel from the Egyptians. It's one of those texts that future biblical authors, as they're writing under the inspiration of the Spirit, will refer back to anytime they need to talk about the fact that our God saves, our God delivers. Our God is a God who helps and intervenes and delivers helpless people. In fact, our text this morning, as we look at this event, is going to demonstrate just that, that God delivers helpless people. If you feel helpless, if you have ever felt helpless, take courage in the fact that the Lord is a God who delivers helpless people. We find Israel this morning in a helpless situation. They cannot save themselves because of where God has put them and led them. And yet here we find that God will indeed deliver them. He will be their Savior. This text is going to demonstrate both what God's people are delivered from, what are we delivered from, as well as how God delivers us. What and how? What are we delivered from, and how does God deliver His people? So when we last left Israel, if you'll remember last Sunday, God had led them out of Egypt. But rather than taking them the obvious direct route to Canaan, the promised land, instead, God sent them in the other direction, and He positioned them between a rock and a hard place, where they were hemmed in by the wilderness and the sea. And so that's where we left Israel. They're in this seemingly precarious situation. They're in front of the sea, camped out. And as we come into the text this morning, the scene is now going to cut back to Egypt. What's going on with Pharaoh and his officials at this time? And it tells us that as Pharaoh begins to take stock of the situation, the reality begins to set in for him that he has just let his entire slave labor force that supported much of the Egyptian economy walk right out the door. And so he and his officials ask in verse 5, they say, "What have we done? You know, we have released Israel from serving us." And the text says, because God hardened Pharaoh's heart, Pharaoh changed his mind. He had remorse for letting them go. And it says that he assembled his military, one of the great military powers in the world at that time. In fact, the text tells us that he assembled the chariots of his military. The chariots at this time would have been very advanced military weaponry that not many nations had access to. These were the tanks of the ancient world. And Pharaoh assembles this powerful military, and they set out in pursuit of the Israelites. And so here's Israel sitting there facing the sea in this precarious situation, and all of a sudden they look out and they see that their worst nightmare, their biggest fear, is coming to fruition as they notice this powerful Egyptian military bearing down on them. They have the sea in front of them, so they can't move forward. They have the wilderness around them, so they can't retreat. And now they have the army of Pharaoh closing in on them. And so verse 10 in the narrative tells us that they were terrified. They were deeply afraid. And so they do what we often do when we get afraid or we grow angry with what God is doing or has done in our lives. We find someone to blame. We find someone to lash out toward. And for them, that someone was their human leader, Moses. They begin complaining. You can hear as you're reading the text, you can hear the sarcasm in their complaints. Verse 11, they said to Moses, you know, is it because there were no graves back in Egypt that you have taken us away to die here in the wilderness? You know, the cemeteries were quite nice in Egypt. What have you done? What have you done by bringing us out of Egypt? Moses, how dare you save us from our forced labor? How dare you save us from our bondage, our slavery, our oppressors? I want you to notice how their question in verse 11 actually parallels the question Pharaoh and his officials asked in verse 5. In verse 5, Pharaoh asked, what have we done in letting the Israelites go? And then in verse 11, the Israelites ask, what have you done in letting us go and bringing us out? It's demonstrating they're not thinking like a redeemed people. They're operating with the same perspective, the same mindset, the same spirit as Egypt, as Pharaoh himself. And then their sarcasm then pivots into the classic, I guess it's as old as humanity, I told you so line, right? Verse 12, they say, you know, isn't this what we told you back in Egypt? You know, we told you this was going to happen. Leave us alone so that we may serve the Egyptians. Now, they say, isn't this what we told you? Is that, it's been a while since we've been in the earlier parts of Exodus. Is that really what they said? Because if I remember correctly, back in chapter 4, when Moses first announced to the people that God had heard their cries for help, this is what they said. This is Exodus 4:31. It says, the people believed, and when they heard that the Lord had paid attention to them and that he had seen their misery, they knelt low and worshiped. It would seem that their, and this is not uncommon, it would seem that their memory of the past doesn't exactly match reality. And so they, you know, they say, it would have been better for us. We were better off serving the Egyptians than coming out here to die in the wilderness. Do you remember that God said, I'm going to deliver you. Why? To serve me. I'm going to bring you out to worship me, to serve me. That's what the Lord told the Israelites. But what they're saying here in a slap of the face to the Lord, they say, you know what? We would have preferred, it was better for us to serve those guys, to be there serving them rather than this God who puts us in places like this, who puts us in positions like this. You know, this moment of crisis that Israel is in is revealing a lot. It's revealing the great depth of what the Lord delivers his people out of, what he delivers them from. I mean, what we have been saying, and it's true, he delivers us from slavery, right? He delivers us from bondage. And you say, yeah, but we already know that in the text. That was chapter 13. We saw that he delivered Israel from slavery. He got them out of Egypt. Now we're in chapter 14. But what we're learning in chapter 14 is that evidently there are There are layers to Israel's slavery. In fact, there are layers to the slavery that we all find ourselves in. There is, to be sure, our objective slavery to the penalty of sin, which is death. God saves us from the bondage of death that we deserve because of our sin. And we saw in the text how God delivered his people from that objective slavery in the Passover, right? Through the blood of the Passover lamb, it atoned for the firstborn so that they were saved. They were delivered from the bondage of death that swept through the land. So by the time we get to chapter 14, objectively, they're out of Egypt. They're out of Egypt. But what we're reading here is that there is evidently also a subjective layer to their slavery. And that's what we're seeing exposed and brought to the surface in chapter 14. It's what I'll call the spirit of slavery. That internal mindset of slavery. And this is the first point that I want you to see this morning. What does God deliver us from? Number one, God delivers us from this spirit of slavery. Not only the objective slavery of our bondage to death because of sin, but from this mindset, this internal spirit of slavery. It would seem that even though objectively Israel is out of Egypt, they're still thinking like, acting like, talking like slaves. They're terrified. They have this internal assumption that God is harsh. He's out to get them. He's not for them. He wants to destroy them. They have this desire to return to their old lives, to return to their masters, their old oppressors. The people are out of slavery, but the slavery has not yet been rooted out of the people. And guys, isn't that the journey that we're all still on? Like many of us here this morning have experienced the objective deliverance of God. That we have been set free from condemnation. We have been set free from the bondage of death through sin. But though even in that sense, though we've come out of Egypt, it doesn't mean that there aren't still times when we still think like slaves, talk like slaves, act like slaves. We all still fight this subjective internal spirit of slavery. I want to unpack that for us just a little bit this morning. The spirit of slavery, it produces fear in our lives. The spirit of slavery produces fear. Do you struggle with fear in your life? Fear can take many forms. It could be the fear of loss. It could be the fear of not having control. Not having control over your life. Not having control of other people. Not having control of situations. Things are out of your control and it brings a deep-seated fear in your heart. It could be a fear of lack, a fear of want, a fear of not having enough. That it doesn't matter how well you plan, how many contingencies you come up with, how much money you save, you always still carry around within you this deeply rooted fear of what if I don't have enough? For many, myself included, it takes the form, this fear takes the form of the fear of man. And really, that's most directly what's happening to Israel here in this text. And I want to point this out to you because it's so clear in the passage. By the time we get to the end of the text in verse 31, we are told that Israel feared the Lord because they had seen his deliverance. They had seen his glory, his powerful salvation. But in verse 10, when they're on the other side facing the Red Sea, it says that they feared, or the CSB translates it, they were terrified because of the Egyptians. It's the same word. It's the same word in verse 10 and verse 31. In verse 10, they feared man more than they feared God. All they could see was the people that were closing in on them. Now for us, often the fear of man does not take the form of some, you know, military, literal military closing in on us. For us, often the fear of man takes the form of being absolutely paralyzed and consumed with what other people think about us. You know, I need to protect my image. I need to please people. I need to perform well. I need to produce enough. I need to say yes to everything because I need their approval. I need their acceptance. I need to fit in with the crowd because I need that affirmation from people. I'm afraid to share my faith. I'm afraid to talk about Jesus. I'm afraid to stand up for truth, to stand on conviction. I'm afraid of not going with the flow. I'm afraid of dressing different, talking different, looking different, having different priorities. I'm afraid of standing out and being rejected, being labeled, being seen as a failure or a fool. The reality is that often we look out at people around us with the same fear in our hearts that Israel had when they looked out and saw the Egyptians closing in on them. It's the fear of man, and this fear of any type of fear, it's rooted, it comes out of the spirit of slavery. The spirit of slavery produces a spirit of fear because there is no safety. There is no security of love in a slave relationship. So there's this fear that grips them because of the spirit of slavery. But beyond fear, the spirit of slavery is also, we see here, anchored in this warped, perverted, twisted view of who God is. The heart of God, the character of God. You know, Israel assumes here that God, he just led us out here into the wilderness to kill us. You see, the spirit of slavery will inevitably view God as cruel, as cold, as distant. Someone that you must always try to please, but you will inevitably fall short. Someone who is against you, out to get you, rather than someone who is actually fighting for you. And as a result, we see Israel here rejecting their God, desiring to go back to their old lives, to go back to their old masters. They can't shake, they've been set free, they can't shake the spirit of slavery in their lives. So I want you to see that what God is doing in the narrative here is so much more than simply delivering the Israelites from the objective slavery of Egypt. He's brought them out of Egypt, but he intends more than that. He intends to deliver them from the spirit of slavery that they still carried out of Egypt with them. And I'm convinced that there are so many Christians who objectively, I'm not questioning their salvation at all, objectively have been set free from the condemnation of God's wrath because they've received the atoning blood of the Passover lamb, Jesus Christ, but they carry with them the same spirit of slavery even today. And I want you to see that if that's where you're at, that God intends to bring the same deliverance in your life. He wants to set you free from that. He intends to deliver us from the spirit of slavery. Listen to just a couple of verses I wrote down here. Paul says, "For we did not receive a spirit of slavery to fall back into fear. Instead, we received the spirit of adoption, by whom we cry out, 'Abba, Father,'" Romans 8:15. There is no fear in love. Instead, perfect love drives out fear because fear involves punishment. But the one who fears is not complete in love. 1 John 4:18. See, the only way to be delivered from the spirit of slavery is knowing and living in and receiving and abiding in the perfect love of our Father, receiving the Father love of God. What are we delivered from? God delivers us not just from the objective reality of slavery, but from the spirit of slavery. Now, let's look at how God responds to the Israelites here. Why don't you go back to verse 15. The Lord said to Moses, "Why are you crying out to me?" So God is reproving the people through the mediator, through their representation, through Moses. And he reproves them for crying out to him. "Why are you crying out to me?" Now, you might read that and think, "I thought we were supposed to cry out to God. Especially in times of distress." Like, don't we read over and over again David doing that in the Psalms? He cries out to the Lord. Why is he rebuking Israel for crying out to him? Well, the Israelites were crying out to God not from a heart of faith, truly believing that God could or would help them. Their cries are coming from a spirit of slavery. They're coming from fear and anger at God. "I want to go back to my old life." And so God rebukes this spirit of fear. He rebukes them. And then he starts directing traffic. He's going to give some direction here. He addresses the Israelites first. He says, "Tell the Israelites to break camp." That phrase, "break camp," it can be translated to set out, or perhaps the best way to capture the idea there is to say, "Tell them to move forward." It's a good word for the people of God. He says, "Quit complaining about your situation. Quit looking backwards and either romanticizing the past or criticizing what led you to the present, and move forward." God says, "I have new experiences of my glory for you to see and to have, and move forward." Now, of course, when Israel looked forward, all they could see was an insurmountable obstacle, namely the Red Sea. I suppose this is as good a place as any to talk about this body of water, what this body of water is, where this body of water is. Virtually all English translations refer to this body of water as the Red Sea. We know the Red Sea. The Hebrew phrase that is used there is Yam Suf. Yam means sea. Suf can mean reeds. And so it's possible that this body of water was referred to something like the Sea of Reeds. Now, some scholars have seen problems with that designation and then translating this or identifying the body of water as the Red Sea, because there's not a lot of reeds growing in and around the Red Sea. And so it's not uncommon for folks to argue that this wasn't the Red Sea. Maybe a different body of water in the more marshy delta region of eastern Egypt, where reeds were more common. By moving the location of Yam Suf away from the Red Sea, some have argued for a naturalistic, a scientific explanation of what happens here. It's not uncommon to find arguments that, you know, what's happening here is not actually a miracle. This is a low tide event. And, you know, this is they're at this marshy delta region, and it just happened to be that, you know, what's usually a pretty deep area of water, low tide has gone out, and so the Israelites were probably led out through as low as 6 inches of water, and, you know, a muddy ground, and they kind of trudged through it. Now, The problem with these types of naturalistic explanation, first of all, is that Yom Suf, we know, when it's used in other parts of the Bible, there are clear, undeniable times and instances where it's clearly talking about the Red Sea. We know that Yom Suf was used to refer often to the Red Sea. In fact, there's a place in 1 Kings where Solomon is porting his ship at Yom Suf. So it's clearly a deep body of water that's able to serve as a port for a big ship. It's why the Septuagint, which is the old Greek translation of the Old Testament, anytime they came to Yom Suf, they translated it as the Red Sea. We don't need to be worried that there's not a lot of reeds growing in and around the Red Sea, because Suf can mean reeds. It can also linguistically refer to the end. This could be the Sea of the End, which would make sense because the Red Sea kind of forms a natural border that represents the end of the Egyptian empire and territory. I believe the traditional view in this instance is the best view, that Israel crossed over the northwest arm of the Red Sea that's known as the Gulf of Suez. If you look at a map in the back of your Bible, you'll see the Red Sea and up like the main body of water, and then coming up from the main body, they're like they look like fingers that go up that are an extension of that sea. At the top of the left finger is the Gulf of Suf, which is where likely Israel crossed over in this particular event. Now, I would say that trying to offer a naturalistic explanation to explain this miracle away makes it very difficult to actually read the words of the text and take them seriously. Regardless of where you place the body of water. This is illustrated quite well by Donald Bridges. He tells a story of a liberal minister who was preaching in an old conservative African-American church, and he referenced the crossing of the Red Sea. And someone from the congregation, shouted out, "Praise the Lord! You know, God leading them children of Israel through such deep waters. What a mighty miracle." And the problem was, this liberal minister didn't believe in miracles. And so he retorted back to the congregant, "This isn't a miracle. You know, this was probably a marshy region. They were probably going through at low tide as little as 6 inches of water." To which the congregant responded back to the minister, "Praise the Lord! Drowning all them Egyptians in 6 inches of water. What a mighty miracle." I have no idea if that is true, if that ever happened. Probably not. But it illustrates the point that you can't read the narrative and take the text seriously and simply explain it away with some scientific explanation. This is a demonstration of the miraculous power of God. What appeared as this insurmountable obstacle was all that Israel could see. But they were told, "Move forward by faith. Move toward the water." God directs Moses, "I want you to raise your staff." When Moses raises his staff, the waters divide, dry land appears. Israel is led across the sea on dry ground with two walls of water on either side. The text then tells us that the angel of the Lord, which, remember, we talked about this back at the burning bush, is likely another theophany. It's a visible manifestation of the presence of God. And remember here, that presence, that theophany, is taking the form of a pillar of cloud, a pillar of fire. Went from the front of the people and moved to the backside of the people to protect their rear flank from the Egyptian army that was closing in on them. And God led his people through on dry ground. He delivered, he saved his people from the Egyptians, from death, from slavery. In fact, the text goes on to tell us that God hardened the heart of the Egyptians, who, instead of seeing another sign, another plague, another sign of God's power in doing the obvious thing to do, retreating, instead their hearts were hardened, and so they doubled down and went in after them. And so once the Israelites were safely across, God tells Moses to stretch out his hand, which caused the waters to come back down on the Egyptians and causing all of them to perish. How does God deliver us? How does God deliver his people? We've already seen what he delivers us from. He delivers us from slavery, more specifically, the spirit of slavery. How does he do it? Here's the second point I want you to see, number two. How does God deliver us? God delivers us by grace, through a faithful mediator. By grace, through a faithful mediator. Because the principle, it's a familiar story, so it can be lost if you're not careful. The principle of grace is so clearly seen in this text. It's captured maybe best in this repeated phrase in the text, "The Lord fights for you." The Lord fights for you. Moses tells the people in verse 14, "Do not be afraid, the Lord will fight for you." In fact, the Egyptians say it in verse 25. The Lord is fighting for them. They even see it. God is the primary actor in the event. He is the God. God is the one who split the sea. God is the one that confused the Egyptians, causing their chariot wheels to get stuck in the mud and throwing them into confusion and panic. God is the one who brought the Israelites out of Egypt and through the sea. And God is the one who brings the waters back down on the Egyptian. That's what God did. That was God's role. That's what he did. What did the Israelites do? What was their role? They walked across. They walked out. They crossed over. Moses' instruction to the Israelites in verse 13 and verse 14 sum it up really well, this principle of grace. Look at it. He says to the Israelites, they're complaining, and you know, he says, "Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. Stand firm and see the Lord's salvation that he will accomplish for you today." Verse 14, "The Lord will fight for you, and you must be quiet." It can be translated, "Be still. Wait on the Lord." It's the principle of grace. It's demonstrating that salvation, the deliverance and salvation of God from beginning to end, is a gracious work of the Lord. You see, every other world religion, in one way or another, tries to approach God in the same way that you would approach building a bridge. If you've ever built a bridge before, you build out, you work hard, you build out a little ways till you have kind of a platform to stand, and then once you're there, you work hard and you try to build it out a little bit further until you get out there a little bit further, and then you keep building and working until you finally arrive to the other side. This is religion. What must I do? How must I work? What must I build? What platform can I build for myself to stand on in order to get to God? But the principle of grace in the gospel of Jesus Christ is utterly unique from that message, whatever form it takes. The gospel says that God doesn't require us to build some bridge of performance, some bridge of devotion, some bridge of sacrifice in order to try to get to him. He doesn't require Israel, build a bridge and get yourself across. The gospel teaches us that God comes to us, he splits the water, and he leads us out. You know, God didn't deliver Israel because they had kept the law. They haven't received the law yet. He didn't deliver Israel because they fought a good fight against the Egyptians and they won, and so now he's going to take them out. He's fighting for them. He delivered them by grace. And beyond the principle of grace, we see the principle of a faithful mediator in the text. Moses in the narrative here is the mediator between God and the people. When the people had an issue with God, and we ain't going to approach that big scary cloud, but we can come to you and take up our problems with him, with you. When God has a rebuke for the people, who does he talk to? Verse 15, he talks to Moses. Why are you crying out to me? Moses hadn't been crying out to the Lord. The people had. He represents the people. He's the mediator for the people. You see, unlike the people in the text, Moses is presented as one who, particularly in verses 13 and 14, responded faithfully. Don't be afraid. The Lord will fight for you. Stand still. But God reproves him. God rebukes him because he's representing the people. And of course, the same mediation is seen in the splitting of the Red Sea. It's through Moses' staff, through Moses' hand that God splits the sea, divides the sea in two. Moses in the text is presented as a faithful mediator that led Israel out of bondage, out of death, out of Egypt. Did you know we got a new Moses? We've got a better Moses than the one that we read about here. This guy ain't going to make it to the promised land. He's a type. He's a preview of something so much better. We have a better Moses whose deliverance brings us not only salvation out of bondage. We have a better Moses whose salvation brings in our lives a new creation. Let me show you this. There are a number of verbal parallels in this text to Genesis 1, the creation narrative. The wind that blows across the sea to split the waters, causing dry land to appear, it's the word ruach. It's the Hebrew word for wind or spirit. It's the same word that's used in Genesis 1 when the ruach, the spirit, wind of God hovered over the face of the watery deep. You see, deep waters in the ancient mind represented chaos and destruction. You can understand that. You ever been out in the open sea? You get it. You can't control the sea. It's chaotic. It's volatile. It's deep. It's deadly. Deep waters represented death and destruction and chaos, which is what covered the earth in the beginning until the ruach of God blew over it. And in Genesis 1:9, using almost identical language that's used in our text in Exodus 14, God divided the waters, causing dry land to appear, bringing chaos into order. This is what he's doing in creation. He's forming and bringing order. It's almost the same language that's used in our text as the ruach, the wind of God blows here again, dividing the water, causing dry land to appear, again bringing chaos into order. It's intentional by the author. Same guy who wrote this, wrote Genesis 1. Israel's deliverance through the Red Sea is presented as a type of new creation. And it's the faithful mediator that's leading them through. I want you to know that Jesus, who is the ultimate faithful mediator, is greater than Moses. He's better than Moses. He's more faithful than Moses. Moses only led Israel across. Moses could not atone for Israel's sin. But Jesus, you see, he was actually thrown into the water, the sign of Jonah. He was thrown into the depths of God's wrath and death. In our place, in order to bring us to God, he experienced chaos and death so that we could experience order and life. It's what the Old Testament refers to as shalom, the peace, the order, the life of God. In this way, God fights for us. God accomplished salvation for us. He delivers us by grace through a faithful mediator. How do we respond to this? How do we respond to the deliverance of God? Two words, fear and faith. First, in the text we see, we fear the Lord. Fear the Lord. This was Israel's response on the other side. Having experienced the salvation of God in verse 31, it tells us the people feared the Lord. They had previously feared Pharaoh in verse 10, wanting to go back and serve him, but now they fear the Lord. They're ready to serve the Lord. Listen, guys, we've talked about this before. You will serve the one whom you fear most. You fear man most, you're going to serve man inevitably. But if your fear for the Lord is greater than your fear of anything else, you will ultimately be drawn to serving the Lord. Those who have seen the powerful deliverance of God in salvation are to fear Him. Live a life of fear, of honor, of reverence, of service to Him. He's my God. That's my King. I'm going to fear you. I'm not going to fear the world around me. I'm going to fear Him. I'm going to serve Him. It's the fear of the Lord. Don't let anything in this world around you cause you to be terrified. Fear the Lord. We live by the fear of the Lord and we walk by faith. Faith. By faith, I mean we must trust and rely upon the Lord. That's our role. Okay, our role is not to fight for our own salvation and deliverance, or to try to fight to prove ourselves worthy to God or man. Human nature loves to do that. It's our nature. You know, we love accomplishing something for ourselves. We love productivity. We feel this inner need to perform, to produce, to do something to save ourselves. We don't like that feeling of helplessness, that humble feeling of I can't help myself here. Hear the words of Moses. Don't be afraid. Stand firm. See the Lord's salvation that He will accomplish for you today. The Lord will fight for you. You must be quiet. Be still. Wait on the Lord. A line from Chuck Swindoll commenting on that verse. He says, you know, talking about how people often respond when they feel panicked. He says, what we typically do when we feel panicked is first, we are afraid. Second, we run. Third, we fight. Fourth, we tell everyone. But God's counsel is just the opposite here. Don't be afraid. Stand still. Watch Him work and keep quiet. We must learn to trust the Lord. Rely upon the Lord. Wait upon the Lord who fights for us. Now that faith is not immobility. It is not passivity or complacency. Our reliance on the Lord is demonstrated in our willingness to move forward and follow Him by faith. When He says to break camp, move toward the water, follow me, watch what I'll do, we must follow Him. That's faith. That's trusting the Lord, and this is how we respond to the deliverance of God. He delivers us from the spirit of slavery by grace through a faithful mediator. We respond by fearing the Lord and trusting Him enough to be still. When He calls us to wait, when He says, hold, be quiet, be still, watch. And when He says, it's time to go. Move toward the water. We move forward at His word. That's a life of faith. Fear and faith. These are the imperatives of a redeemed people. I want you to know, church, no matter what insurmountable obstacle lie in your way in life, I'm telling you, fear the Lord. Trust Him. The Lord will fight for you.